Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a history book that we find interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week we're happy to have Chris Capizzola on the show. His new book, Uncle Sam Wants You, World War I and the Making of the Modern American Citizen, has just come out from Oxford University Press. You might remember that a couple of weeks ago we talked to Kimberly Jensen, who wrote a book on a similar topic, Mobilizing Minerva. I learned a lot during that interview. And I learned a lot during this interview as well. I hope that you do too. Here's the interview. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Marshall.
How are you today?
I'm doing just fine, thank you.
You're in sunny Boston, is that correct?
Yes, indeed.
Or someplace like that. I used to live in Boston, and I don't remember it being sunny that often, but maybe that's just me.
Our summers are nice.
Yes, no, it's quite true. I enjoyed my time there. Today, we're talking to Chris Capizzola about his new book, Uncle Sam Wants You, World War I and the Making of the Modern American Citizen. As I said in the introduction, we talked to Kimberly Jensen a few weeks ago, who wrote a book on a similar topic, or I guess I would say a related topic. So I was particularly interested to have Chris on the show, and the folks at Oxford University Press, who Chris should be very proud of, contacted me about the opportunity to interview you today. So again, we're very appreciative that you're on the show. If you could, why don't you begin by telling our listeners just a little bit about yourself, where you grew up and where you went to school, and if you had mentors and that kind of thing.
Sure. Well, first of all, thanks for having me on the show.
My pleasure.
And I grew up actually in upstate New York in a small town, in so many ways a small sort of old-fashioned American town.
Mm-hmm.
I think actually kind of stayed with me a little bit when I was trying to figure out people from an earlier generation that fought in World War I.
Mm-hmm.
And then I studied only a little bit of American history in college, and mm-hmm. actually took a kind of detour into American history for graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
And actually partly got into the whole thing because I had been a teacher. I taught 7th, 8th, and 9th grade social
studies. Is that right? Wow.
Yes.
That's great.
Yes.
That's great experience,
and,
isn't it?
It's a great experience, and in fact, I probably learned more history the years that I was teaching it than any other time. And so, but I also felt like I wasn't done learning history, and so that's part
mm-hmm.
of what got me back into graduate school in the first place. And then I decided I liked the idea of being a history professor,
mm-hmm.
teaching and writing and all that goes with it.
Other things we do.
Yes.
Here at Iowa, we actually empty the trash as well, so it's not probably different
at
MIT.
And clean up from the floods,
yeah,
I guess.
That's
from,
right,
from,
the flood.
From what I was getting
who knew? Yeah. Uh-huh. And so then you went on to graduate school. Who did you study with there?
I did. I was in graduate school at Columbia,
uh-huh.
and my main advisor was Alan Brinkley, who's a very well-known 20th century political historian,
uh-huh.
and obviously he influenced me a lot in my own research. And particularly at this time that I was in grad school in the 1990s, there were a lot of people who were looking for ways to come back to political history and kind of bring questions of politics back toward the center of the field. And they've always been at the center of, I think, 20th century American history.
Certainly.
But for a long time, people were very interested in social history questions, and one of
uh-huh.
my other main advisors there was a professor, Elizabeth Blackmar, who really trained me a lot in the kind of techniques and approaches of social history.
Uh-huh.
And, they both sort of influenced me together and kind of got me interested in the late 19th and early 20th centuries.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then the actual genesis of the book, actually, I think is often the case for a lot of historians, that I found a footnote in another book that was very, that was just very puzzling. And once I started researching it, basically I never stopped.
No, I've had similar experiences, and I'm sure that many historians have. There's always something that catches your eye or your fancy, and pretty soon it's 5 years later, and you're talking to publishers about some book. So then why don't we actually just begin talking about the book itself?
Mm-hmm.
One of the general theses of the book, and I'm not an American historian, so pardon my ignorance, one of the theses of the book has to do with this concept of, you call it coercive voluntarism, which I think some people might think is a kind of oxymoron, but you do a nice job of explaining what it is. Maybe you could talk a little bit about what it is in the context of American political culture and history.
No, sure, absolutely. It's a concept that it is it Well, it's a contradiction in terms, but
yeah.
I think it also tells us a little something about how American political culture, and probably other political cultures as well, work. And particularly for me, the puzzle about the First World War was how such a large war mobilization effort got off the ground relatively quickly and without a really substantial presence for the federal government already on the ground in most communities.
Uh-huh.
And then knowing that the early 20th century was a time when Americans were active in clubs and voluntary associations, I thought, well, they must be tapping into these voluntary associations.
Uh-huh.
And I went into the project thinking, you know, that was going to be a kind of overall pretty cheery story.
Uh-huh.
And then over time, I started to find actually that it was a place where voluntarism was often involved a lot of arm twisting,
mm-hmm.
And a lot of sort of convincing people through the techniques of how we know other people in our communities to get on board with something,
mm-hmm.
whether it's to buy bonds or mobilize the community for the draft or to keep an eye on suspicious people in the community,
mm-hmm.
outsiders or German Americans,
mm-hmm.
And sort of one place after another, I started finding this pattern.
So does coercive voluntarism, is that an older aspect of American political culture? The reason I mention it is because it brings to mind a different way of looking at something I think many of the listeners will be familiar with, and that is the way Tocqueville described American political
mm-hmm.
culture as also very voluntaristic, but he liked it a lot. He thought it was
right.
a great thing. He thought all this joining was a wonderful thing and was a kind of bulwark against tyranny. But your take on it is a little different.
It is, absolutely. And in fact, I had, you know, sort of gone into it having read Tocqueville. And and then the interesting thing was discovering that people in the early 20th century actually really didn't read Tocqueville very much. That he didn't really – he actually
yeah.
wasn't really well known to Americans at that time period.
Uh-huh.
And they're – in fact, these voluntary associations were often, at a time when the federal government wasn't really around, were actually not always a sort of break on the tyranny of the majority, but in fact the way that was carried out. It was often a way that the dominant ideas suppressed minority ideas in particular communities. And voluntary associations didn't just, you know, sell bonds and save wheat. They also regulated and policed communities,
yeah.
Particularly in the absence of large-scale police forces
that
we know in modern America.
Right, which were almost everywhere absent at the time. I mean, 19th century states in general were quite small. And even the ones that we think of as quite large were quite small. I study Russia, and I can tell you that the number of people running the Russian Empire in the 19th century is shockingly low.
Yeah.
There really weren't many boots on the ground, as we like to say now, and I think the same is true of America, and we don't know this. The other thing that I found really interesting, in addition to coercive voluntarism in your book, was the fact that the entire apparatus, and I hadn't really thought of this before, that now protects what we call civil rights, and I think really should probably be called individual rights, was absent at the time. It just didn't exist. Could you talk a little about that?
Yeah, no, definitely. That when people sort of talk about their understanding of what they owed to the government, you know, what their obligations were in wartime, they talked very much about obligations, and they didn't talk as much about rights
mm-hmm.
As they do in the 20th century. The historians call it the rights revolution,
mm-hmm.
and that was a product largely of the civil rights movement of the second half of the 20th century, but even before that. But notions of individual civil liberties, personal freedom of speech were much more limited in their
mm-hmm.
definition
mm-hmm.
than they are now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so when we look at the home front during World War I, when there was a significant repression of individual liberties, often it was carried out by people who didn't necessarily think that they were doing anything wrong, because they didn't have the same sensibilities about rights and civil liberties that we do now, looking back at it.
Mm-hmm.
So one of
mm-hmm.
the things for me, you know, in doing the research on the project was trying to figure out, you know, what people really thought they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
There's a section in the book, where I look at librarians during the First World War.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, librarians are not exactly a sexy topic, but it actually turns out to be a very interesting kind of question.
Mm-hmm.
And books were very important to soldiers,
mm-hmm.
for obvious reasons. This was before, you know, there were some movies that were shown to soldiers in France, but most of what they did to entertain themselves was to read books and magazines that were sent to them.
Mm-hmm.
And libraries really felt that they had a kind of special obligation to express the war effort. But librarians themselves also felt they had, along with that, an obligation to eliminate dangerous ideas, to protect mm-hmm. citizens from mm-hmm. unpopular ideas. And that led to a lot of libraries and librarians eliminating German books from communities, restricting access to the libraries themselves,
mm-hmm.
And participating in the dissemination of information that wasn't called propaganda at the time, but then in retrospect, I'm sure, you know, we would recognize as such.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And in the years since, you know, we look back at people like that and think, oh, they were out to suppress civil liberties.
Mm-hmm.
But one of my points along the way is that they had a different mindset.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely true. I think that's totally true. I've been studying recently the history of censorship, and it's only quite, at least in my own sort of preliminary research, it's only quite recently that we have expanded the notion of freedom of the press past print and political speech.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing else was covered. Like I interviewed someone on the show a few weeks ago who pointed out, and I just didn't even realize this, that, you know, movies are not protected speech. Not
right.
Even today, they're not protected speech. But we somehow have this folk notion that freedom of expression allows you to basically say or do whatever you want. But actually, that's quite a modern thing. I want to ask a challenging question, though, and it's this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you look at the sort of late 18th century, you know, Republican doctrine as captured by, let's say, the Declaration of the Rights of Man and Citizens, or you know, our own Constitution, there's ample stuff in there about rights.
Mm-hmm.
There's the genesis of rights talk. Why did it take so long to come to fruition, and how did it come to fruition?
No, that's a good question, and I think that the best way to think about that is to think about how our political culture always includes many strands that are woven together.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not always, you know, a Republican society or a liberal society.
Mm-hmm.
And that we've actually sort of brought all of these things together at different times. So, of course, we have a rights tradition that goes back to the 18th century.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, our sense of obligation and our sense of loyalty to groups didn't disappear
mm-hmm.
Over the 20th century. Even today, we, you know, we still volunteer and we still think we owe things to one another. But, in fact, what I'm actually sort of trying to argue is not that there was a rights revolution in the 20th century that replaced a culture of obligation, but in fact just that that the balance of the weight
mm-hmm.
shifted a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And in the early 20th century, you had a political culture that defined citizenship more around obligation, and then that political culture went to war.
Mm-hmm.
And war, of course, is a time that brings questions of obligation to the fore, whether it's military obligation of conscription or other obligations. And so that sort of amplified this culture of obligation, but it also had the kind of effect of also amplifying sense of rights among those who saw things a different way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, I see.
And that was, yes, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, yeah, that's interesting. One of the things, yeah, I mean, it's I've been reading, for example, this sort of predecessors to the ACLU, which was founded, mm-hmm. if I'm not incorrect, in the 1920s, but it had predecessors. Mm-hmm. There was a thing called the Free Speech Society or something. And,
yeah.
And they all call on these sort of 18th century documents, and they're all pointing mm-hmm. right at them, saying, look, 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 there's a kind of canonical reference to this, and we should be able to do this. But the courts just aren't persuaded at all. They just like,
yeah.
Nope, sorry. That's not the way we're going to read that. I mean, we read it as clear as a bell. Freedom of speech is freedom of speech, and that's that. But the courts,
yeah.
at the time, these were smart people, were reading it and going, nope, that's not what it means, not at all. And
yeah.
you can't do
well,
this, you can't do that, yeah.
There's a reason for that, that goes to the Progressive Era, right? And the Progressive Era, you know, was trying to, you know, to bring progress to society, certain kinds of changes. And many of the legislative efforts of the progressives, in fact, had failed in American courts precisely because of rules about individual freedom. Mm-hmm. So, for example, laws limiting the number of hours that workers could work
mm-hmm.
were overturned on the premise that these were violations of individual liberties to work.
Mm-hmm.
And so many people who would have thought of themselves as progressive, mm-hmm. forward-looking people in the 1910s, thought of individual rights language as something old-fashioned and meant to undo their agendas. Mm. And in fact, Oliver Wendell Holmes on the Supreme Court dismissed this notion as what he called, you know, a relic of the horse and buggy age.
Hmm. Interesting.
And so that's why it's all the more interesting that people like that then turned over the course of the 20th century to see that that rights talk in the realm of politics and political expression and personal expression in the arts and film and drama and fields like that would not necessarily mean that they also had to give up the kind of agendas for changing economic rights that they were looking for. And some of this sort of comes together then in the 1930s.
Uh-huh.
With the New Deal.
Yeah, no, I see just what you mean. I find all that, yeah, it's a convincing way to think about it, that there are these various strands, and some of them are keys, and some of them are sort of played more loudly than, or pulled harder than others at different points in time. That makes a certain amount of sense to me, because we always come back to these same texts. We just read them in strikingly different ways. If I could ask you to tell us a little bit about the American Protective League, which I found a fascinating mm-hmm. part of the book. Maybe you could tell a story of that.
Yes, absolutely. Well, that's what got me started on the research for this book in the first place. That's the sort of footnote. There's mm-hmm. in a book called Over Here by the historian David Kennedy,
mm-hmm.
which is a standard history of the First World War. And he mentioned in the footnote that there was this group called the American Protective League, which had 250,000 members at its peak, maybe, and that they carried out, they were volunteers who did sort of voluntary enforcement of the draft.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember reading that footnote and thinking, well, this is interesting. You know, 250,000 people who volunteered to enforce the draft, there's got to be a story there.
Yeah.
And in fact, it turns out that there is. And the American Protective League was a quasi-official organization. It was started as a voluntary association, and it was a men's group overwhelmingly. There were only a handful of women who participated in it, and it drew on kind of 19th century men's organizations, Elks,
mm-hmm.
and other sort of lodges like that.
Mm-hmm.
And most of its members were men who were too old to be drafted, or for other reasons they were just not going to be serving in the military. But who felt somehow that the draft as it was passed was not being fully enforced, right? So remember that Selective Service is passed in May of 1917, right after the war comes in.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a very popular policy. And for it to be enforced, it requires the voluntary registration of every man in the United States between 18 and eventually it's raised to 45, 18 to 45.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not a big enforcement procedure. The federal, what becomes the FBI, the Justice Department's Bureau of Investigation, has only about 150 agents.
Mm-hmm.
And there isn't a really good way of tracking the American citizens either, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is an era before Social Security cards,
mm-hmm.
An era before almost anyone carried a passport,
mm-hmm.
Before driver's licenses, before even birth certificates,
mm-hmm.
for a lot of people, particularly if they were immigrants. And so the enforcement of the draft required a certain kind of voluntary registration, but as it was clear that large numbers of people who opposed it might simply not be registering,
mm-hmm.
the American Protective League sort of formed and offered its services to the Justice Department to aid in enforcing the draft.
Mm-hmm.
And they were active in most parts of the country, almost every region of the country, and they did different things in different places, but some of the most interesting things that I found them doing were what were called slacker raids.
Yes, exactly. I wanted you to talk about those a little bit.
Yeah, and these are astonishing things once you actually start thinking about them. And a slacker was the kind of slang term in the early 20th century for a draft dodger. They would have just been called slackers. And the American Protective League decided to go on raids to try to track down the slackers and make sure that they had registered and that they were serving. And so in countries all across the United States, the thousands of American Protective League volunteers would organize on a particular day, usually in coordination with the municipal police or actually with state militias or state home guards. And they would basically go through the streets of a particular town looking for and asking every man who looked like he was of draft age to show them his draft card.
Mm-hmm.
And the largest one of them all was in New York City in September of 1918, probably about 50,000 people participated from the American Protective League and from other organizations. And they would particularly, obviously, they would target places where they thought they would find large numbers of draft-age men. So they would go into restaurants and saloons. They would go into baseball parks. There was one in Chicago where they sort of surrounded an entire baseball park during a game.
Mm-hmm.
But what's interesting, and this is sort of what really surprised me most about it, is that the slacker raids really didn't turn up very many slackers.
Yeah, no, I found that interesting. Why is that?
That, in fact, actually, most of the people who needed to register for the draft already had.
Uh-huh.
Often they were motivated by whether it's their own personal desire to serve, or they were simply motivated by a sense that that if they didn't, they might lose their job, or they might be shamed by their community, or they might be sort of called out if their name wasn't on the list of registrants that was published in the local newspaper. And so, you know, often the people who ended up falling through the cracks fell through the cracks not because they didn't register, but because they weren't carrying the card, or they'd registered in the wrong place. And so a lot of the aspect of the draft was learning sort of how to be good bureaucratic 20th century American citizens and carry our draft cards, among other things. So the draft card was the first mass-issued identity document in American history.
Uh-huh. No, yeah, it's very interesting. I hate to say it, but the APL, the American Protective League, reminded me of nothing more than brown shirts during the Nazi era, or actually the Soviets had a similar sort of thing where they would force people. Well, there's a difference in the sense that this was an organization, but this was truly a volunteer organization, though, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
the
people really just joined. They weren't compelled to join this organization. Yeah. So in that sense, it's more like the brown shirts than it is like the Soviet equivalents. But the notion that you would press people into service that was quote-unquote voluntary, it seems somewhat characteristic of the 20th century notion of voluntary assent. That is, that you should give your will over to something, but you have to do it voluntarily or it doesn't count. Could you talk a little bit about that? You see what I mean?
I do see what you mean. I mean, I do think it is worth distinguishing, you know, that the American Protective League, although it had a loose affiliation with the Justice Department, it never really had enforcement power that any of the, that any organization like that in Germany or in the Soviet Union had, I think. And so it was, one of the more, just as interesting as the slacker raids is the kind of the protests against them from people who say, I'm a good American citizen. I don't need to follow you. You know, where's your warrant? Things like that. And debates in Congress and elsewhere. So I think so there are some important distinctions.
Yeah, no,
in that sense.
I see what you mean. Maybe we could talk a little bit about the way in which these, what we might call the enforcement of voluntary or of coercive voluntarism, tended to break along ethnic lines. I thought one of the most interesting parts of the book had to do with the Mennonites in Kansas, because that's actually the area where I grew up. I'm not a Mennonite myself, but you would mention towns, and I'd say, I've been there. I know people there.
Yeah.
The Mennonites are still there, and they're doing just fine. Maybe you could talk a little bit about the Mennonites and actually the Germans in the United States at the time.
Yes, absolutely. And I guess one of the things I should do is include in that is a sort of a little bit of praise and thanks to the Mennonite historians who over the years, particularly at Bethel College North Newton, Kansas, have done a really phenomenal job in recording and making available interviews and letters and testimonies, and they've been putting a lot of them on their website as well, so other people who want to kind of do some more research can really get a really rich set of sources for all kinds of questions, not just in terms of religious history, but really just how a farming community works. I write about the Mennonites in part for their particular situation as conscientious objectors, right? And so if you have two people who have two conflicting obligations, their obligation to the state and their obligation to their religion. Those conflicts have to be worked out in the time of war. And this was World War One was probably the worst time in American history to be a conscientious objector. That even in the 19th century, there had been in many ways much more protections and exemptions than there were in World War One. And then later, in World War Two and Vietnam, exemptions were for religious objectors, particularly if they were formerly members of the church, was actually much more standardized than it was in the early 20th century. Now, Mennonites had it extra hard because although they weren't actually German, almost all the Mennonites who were living in places like Kansas had been either born in the United States or actually had been born in Russia to sort of German-speaking and German heritage organizations. But nevertheless, they were German-speaking. And they were outsiders in these communities, and they were very frequently targeted for scrutiny, for investigation, and sometimes for violence. Because just sort of imagine if you're living in a community where the draft has come in, and takes, especially if you're a rural farming community in central Kansas, and the draft comes in and takes sort of all the young men, and except it doesn't take the Mennonite men, who are German-speaking and who are farmers, and this is a time when farmers, actually, there's an enormous agricultural boom, and so there's all kinds of tensions because these farmers now are making a lot of money, and so a lot of ongoing tensions within communities play out and actually become quite violent. That central Kansas is one of the most violent places during the course of the war. And the Mennonites responded with some hesitation because they felt they needed to protect themselves, but protecting themselves meant entering formal politics, participating in worldly ways that many Mennonites would object to. But over time, they sort of learned how to do that, and they sort of fought for that. And the conscientious objectors were never very many, never more than a few hundred, but nevertheless, a few thousand, they were actually some of the most talked about of American citizens, and I thought that was really quite interesting, that their story was a way for Americans, many of whom never met a conscientious objector in their lives, to nevertheless try to figure out, well, what exactly does it mean to have a draft in our society, and how do we reconcile that with our other obligations, our other senses of freedoms?
And how specifically did the conscientious objector, which is an odd term, I must say, it goes clang against the ear, conscientious objector, how did the actual term and the legislation itself come about? Because it didn't exist prior to World War One.
It did not. There were some exemptions in 18th and 19th century communities, but the term actually originates from objectors to vaccination, which was something I discovered only by looking the term up in the dictionary in its etymology. The 19th century laws requiring vaccination, of course, also there were people who refused that. And then the term was applied in the U.S., and the first draft law included an exemption for people who could demonstrate that they were members of what were called historic peace churches.
Mm-hmm.
And many of these are still around, Mennonites, Amish, mm-hmm. Quakers, and others. And the law basically said, well, those people should still register, and they should still go to a military camp if they're drafted, but President Wilson will figure out something else for them to do.
Mm-hmm.
But the law didn't say what that was.
Mm-hmm.
And so many people registered as conscientious objectors. And if they were officially members of churches, they had some abilities. But, of course, many churches in the early 20th century weren't very good at keeping records,
mm-hmm.
at, necessarily recording their members, knowing exactly what they believed, particularly for sort of small, whether they were pietistic or whether they were particularly evangelical,
mm-hmm.
It may have been just a set of individual beliefs. People who individually believed in pacifism often had a very hard time
mm-hmm.
Demonstrating that they should be exempted.
Mm-hmm.
And then where things got particularly complicated was this requirement that conscientious objectors should still go to military camps when drafted.
Yes, I found that very interesting. We'll give you the status of a conscientious objector, and then we're going to send you to an army camp if you're drafted.
Yeah.
That puts you in an odd situation.
Yes, and it puts you in a lot of it's a very serious test for a lot of people. And remember, a lot of these are 18-year-old young men who... some of whom are very well trained in their churches, some of whom are not,
uh-huh.
And certainly all of them are separated from their home communities and their home ministers or other religious leaders, and they're under enormous amounts of pressure from other draftees who look at these conscientious objectors and they see treason, they see unmanliness, they see they see all kinds of problems, and they tell them that.
Mm-hmm.
And many conscientious objectors arrived in camp as COs and left with uniforms on.
Yeah, no, exactly. I think the majority of them did, didn't they?
The overwhelming majority.
Yeah, no, that's
probably, at least three quarters.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about a kind of related question, and that is the notion of the enemy alien, which just
mm-hmm.
simply sounds like something out of science fiction, doesn't it? It really sounds
yeah.
horrendous. That one doesn't go clang against the ear, but it makes the hairs on the back of your neck stand up. What were enemy aliens, and how did the legislation in the category come about?
Yes. The enemy aliens are people who are citizens of the nations with which the United States is at war. And for all practical purposes, in the First World War, that means Germany.
Mm-hmm.
That we were, of course, also at war with the Austro-Hungarian Empire, but most of the people in the U.S. who were citizens of the Austro-Hungarian Empire tended to be also opponents of that regime. They were members of minority ethnic groups like
mm-hmm.
Czechs
mm-hmm.
And so forth. And the United States never actually declared war on the Ottoman Empire,
mm-hmm.
So that was kind of a non-issue. But so you have a substantial number of German citizens in the United States, and then, of course, also larger German-American communities, people
mm-hmm.
who've been here for a generation or more. But the regulation of them really begins with the citizens of Germany. And this is prompted by international law. All of the powers of World War I did this to enemies, and there were regulations that required them to register, sometimes regulations on their movement, and
mm-hmm.
so forth. America's law for regulating enemy aliens actually dates all the way back to 1798.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, actually, rather than passing a new law, we dusted off an old one that goes all the way back to the Alien and Sedition Acts of the Adams administration.
Mm-hmm.
And we set up a series of regulations for where enemy aliens could and couldn't go, whether they could maintain firearms, what kinds of jobs they could get, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And there was some discussion, and really substantial and, in fact, actually serious discussion about whether to intern all German citizens
mm-hmm.
In some sort of internment camps.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is a story that almost no one knows about the United States during the First World War. And it's hard to tell the story without the Second World War sort of casting a shadow over it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so these were not like the plan was not for something like what happened to the Japanese in mm-hmm. the Second World War, who were interned regardless of their citizenship,
mm-hmm.
Included both Japanese Americans and Japanese citizens.
Mm-hmm.
In World War I, there was a sort of investigation, there was a plan. A series of sort of experts went down to Washington to present their plans, and they thought about how much it would cost. The Wilson administration, the cabinet, discussed it in a cabinet meeting, and several members of the cabinet supported large-scale internments of what would probably have been tens of thousands of people.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, it didn't happen, partly because there was not enough interest in it from the War Department, which were the people who were going to have to run it and going to have to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
And they were at that moment really worried about how they were going to pay for their own soldiers, let
mm-hmm.
alone take care of others. It was a telling, it sort of shows that it was on people's mind, and it was a real surprise for me to read. I kind of came across these things in the archives and sort of tucked away in a few different libraries, the plans.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really sort of shocked to see them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was somewhat familiar with them in the sense that, having studied, as I say, Russia,
mm-hmm.
Russia did a lot of this kind of thing during World War I,
mm-hmm.
that is segregating, classifying and segregating populations. The Germans did it as well. I can't speak for the French or the British, but it was a reasonably
yeah.
common thing to do. The notion that if you had people of quote-unquote foreign extraction in your country and you were at war with their country of birth or of origin, that they should be somehow surveilled or locked up was, I think, an extraordinarily common one at the time. I think we could even say it was common sense to those people that they should be watched very carefully.
Yeah.
This level of suspicion toward German Americans, or Germans, I guess as we could actually call them, that is the German national, had interesting effects. One of them that you point out in your book that I'd like you to talk about a little bit is the cultural effect. I mean, it ended, I don't know if it ended, but it certainly changed German American culture very quickly in a very short period of time.
Yeah.
Maybe you could talk a little about that.
No, that is absolutely true. And I think that one of the most interesting sort of facts that I came across along the way was that in 1915, about one quarter of high school students in the United States took German in high school. And by 1922, only 1% did.
Yeah.
Right? And it stayed at that percent basically ever since.
Uh-huh.
And that was just a sign for a larger whole network of German cultural organizations, in voluntary associations, political societies, shooting clubs, singing clubs, sort of you name it, newspapers, schools. Some of the largest experiments in bilingual education in American history were in German schools in the early 20th century. And it is certainly the case that that cultural life was declining as German immigrants were assimilating into American culture,
uh-huh.
broadly speaking.
Yeah.
That rates of immigration from Germany were going down, and that German culture would not have stayed that vibrant for forever.
Yeah.
Particularly, if we look at what 20th century, all kinds of immigrant ethnic cultures declined in the early 20th century as people tried to be more
mm-hmm.
and more American as they understood it.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, what actually happened in the war is a dramatic and drastic assault on German, not just sort of German culture in terms of, German music and German literature, although that's obviously that's targeted. But as I tried to explain in the book, that's actually an assault on German-American voluntary association
mm-hmm.
And political culture,
mm-hmm.
right? And at a time when voluntary associations are the central mechanisms whereby people participate in public life,
mm-hmm.
That an assault on German-American singing clubs is actually an assault on a German-American community and
mm-hmm.
their political and public power, broadly speaking.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, I found it really interesting because actually having lived in both Kansas and in Boston, where you are right now, I mean, I know just to take the second case, there are scattered all over sort of Cambridge and Somerville and Boston, there are still ethnic clubs. There are Italian-American clubs. There are Portuguese clubs in Cambridge itself. There are Armenian clubs I've seen them and been to some of them in these areas. And none of that exists anymore in Kansas. There's no German, I never encountered one when I was growing up. There's no German-American club. There are no German restaurants, really. Nobody brands themselves as German anymore, I think. And do you think that's a result of this moment?
I would say that this moment is the number one reason why that happened. Just because so many of the organizations that were like that disappeared during the war, that things that would have sustained that, clubhouses and newspapers and things like that.
But it's very odd. Nobody says. I'm sorry to interrupt, but nobody says these days. You know, my friend Francesco Isolani, who will be glad to hear his name mentioned. He's an Italian American, and will just say so, even though his people have been here forever. But I'm sort of quasi of German extraction, but I never think of myself as a German American, and I don't know anybody who does. I mean, but I'm sure I'm surrounded by them here in the Midwest. I'm sure they're all over the place.
Yeah.
But nobody says I'm a German American.
Well, yes, and there are these organizations, of course. And there are a couple other things to remember. Part of it is that it's not just the first war, but of course the second makes it sort of impolitic. Own that identity. But one other thing to remember, though, is remember that most immigrants who arrived in the United States speaking German weren't necessarily quote-unquote German.
Yes, that's right.
So many of them came before Germany was unified, and their strongest identities would have been to a particular region, Bavaria, or wherever. And so, so it's an identity national identity they might not have claimed in quite the same way.
Yeah, and with all due respect to my German friends, German food isn't really that good, so it's okay, you know.
Yeah.
I'll say it's okay. I'll eat the occasional Wurst or something. Maybe you could talk a little bit about the way in which coercive volunteerism affected two groups we haven't talked about yet, that is women and African Americans.
Mm-hmm.
You could start with women.
Okay, yes, and it's one of the things that's of course, remarkable about the home front during the war is that this is a time when the central way that people discuss their obligations, the most important obligation that one can offer as a citizen during wartime, is military service, and that's an avenue that is just not open to very many women. There were a few thousand women who volunteered in various forms for the military, but the draft, of course, didn't draft women. But then the question still remained, well, what is the obligation of a woman citizen during wartime? And women were asked to do many things that included, some things that we sort of know from wartime posters or stories, whether it's knitting socks for soldiers or saving food. And over time, historians never really took those very seriously. They thought, those were really just ways of making people feel like they were sort of participating in the home front. But in fact, the fact of the matter is that the creation at home of millions of garments at a time when, in fact, most garments were constructed in homes. This is when, there aren't real factories, clothing factories, that a lot of work is done in what's called homework, in tenements and elsewhere. In fact, actually, the kind of knitting and sewing that people did actually was really substantial and central to, but it also required the mobilization of a substantial amount of unpaid labor. And this is where I think volunteerism for early 20th century women is particularly worth sort of stopping and thinking about, what does it mean to volunteer? Right. Often when we use the word volunteer, we mean, well, it's voluntary because it's not required. Right? And that's really how people talked about it a lot at the time. But something that's voluntary, we also think that it means it's unpaid. Right? And, of course, women historically have done a lot of labor without getting paid for it. and particularly in the early 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
And so mobilizing women as volunteers was also a way to mobilize women's unpaid labor,
mm-hmm.
Whether that's in areas of food and clothes or mm-hmm. even just maintaining military families while husbands and fathers are away,
mm-hmm.
Is a significant amount of work.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the other things that I looked at was that coercive volunteerism, of course, is not just a male phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
And the slacker raids were a male phenomenon. They were, you know, targeted men, and the people who were doing the targeting were almost exclusively men.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have spectacular events like that that targeted women.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, actually, you do have less spectacular events that reflected just the different ways that men and women moved through cities and towns in
mm-hmm.
the early 20th century. So one thing that I write about are what were called the Hoover Food Pledges.
Mm-hmm.
This was named after Herbert Hoover,
whose
job at that point was to mobilize the U.S. Food Administration.
Mm-hmm.
And the food pledge every woman in America was asked to sign this, saying that she would save food for the war effort.
Mm-hmm.
And the signatures were collected in particular communities by groups of women volunteers. Probably
mm-hmm.
about 500,000 women were volunteer sort of collectors of signatures and pledges
mm-hmm.
For the Food Administration. And they went from house to house visiting particular communities, asking for food pledges and signatures. And in many ways, I would argue that did a lot of the same work as the slacker raid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was a way of sort of
mm-hmm.
kind of face-to-face way of telling people to get on board, to do their part. And I came across all kinds of interesting stories of people who didn't care to be visited.
Mm-hmm.
You know, rumors went around that, you're going to have to turn over all of your food. You know, this is a time when people would can large numbers of goods for the winter.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so it was a serious concern. You know, well, I don't want to have to turn over all of my canned goods. What are we going to eat this winter?
Mm-hmm.
So that led to some protests, to some concerns, and some conflicts in communities all across the country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember when I was talking to Kim Jensen about her book,
mm-hmm.
you know, that some of these groups, and I'm thinking of nurses and doctors, female nurses and doctors, who they weren't called up, but they found themselves participating, let's put it in that way, in the war effort, that some of them actually lobbied for, well, obviously they lobbied for the franchise, but they also lobbied, for example, for officer status. What they really wanted, it was kind of interesting, what they really wanted was not a special status, but just some status,
mm-hmm.
period, end of story. You know, they just wanted to
yeah.
be in the Army, which is, from our perspective, a bizarre thing.
Oh,
but
yeah.
That's really what they wanted. They wanted to be in the
yeah.
Army, and the Army said no. The Army ended up saying no.
No, it's true. One of my favorite sort of stories is that there was a phrase at the time during the war of what were called dollar-a-year men, and these are often sort of corporate executives and people like that who went to Washington for the token salary of $1 a year, and they worked for the war effort.
Uh-huh.
But there were, you know, actually hundreds, probably thousands of leading women, heads of major women's organizations who also moved to Washington and also worked on behalf of the war effort.
Uh-huh.
But they didn't even get $1.
Yeah.
Right. And, so it sort of goes to show
there,
even when you're volunteering, right, and
yeah.
even when you say, you know, you're doing it for nothing,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
that $1
yeah.
was not there.
No, I think it's a very good point, because really what they wanted was just a certain amount of recognition for what they were doing, and they were refused it again and again, which I found sort of remarkable, and Kim's book is very good. I would recommend it to anybody.
Oh, yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about African Americans then. How did they respond or participate in coercive volunteerism?
Yeah. Well, the one of the most interesting sort of questions that emerges during the war is how the draft is going to affect African American communities. And there is, in the public record, if you look in at the speeches of leading black figures, if you read the African-American press, if you look in sort of visible public places, you will find almost no objection
mm-hmm.
to the draft, almost no objection to the war during the war. And, of course, In many ways, this is most famously captured by W.E.B. Du Bois's editorial in The Crisis, the magazine of the NAACP, where he urges African Americans to, quote, close ranks, mm-hmm. right, to sort of set aside our concerns for now, show that we're on board with the war effort, and be rewarded in turn.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, what any good historian will tell you is, well, if you were just reading the public record, you're not reading enough.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, once you sort of dig deeper into this, you find that there are tensions in various communities about particularly in sort of the rural South, and this is a time when African Americans are overwhelmingly in the South and overwhelmingly in the rural parts of the South,
mm-hmm.
And particularly how the draft is going to affect African American labor
mm-hmm.
and labor markets in the South. And in fact, many sort of the landed, sort of prosperous white farmers in the South actually opposed the draft, opposed the war mobilization, because they didn't want to lose African American workers.
Mm-hmm.
But the draft also has an enormous effect on African Americans as they do start in small numbers to move northward, and this is the period known as the Great Migration.
Mm-hmm.
In its size, it's nowhere near as big as World War II, but mm-hmm. in its significance, it was enormous. And that many of the things that happen in the Harlem Renaissance and Chicago has its own version in the 1920s happened because the populations of African Americans in those communities boomed during the war.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that, you know, we sort of know that story, but one of the things that we never really stopped to think about was, well, how do some very poor people who live in some of the most cash-poor parts of the country actually buy their train tickets to go north to Chicago
mm-hmm.
or Philadelphia or where else? And the sort of short answer to that question is what's called allotments.
Mm-hmm.
That an allotment requires that whenever any American soldier was drafted, half of his salary went directly to
yeah.
his wife
mm-hmm.
or dependent of some sort. In cash,
mm-hmm.
right? And so sort of enormous cash transfers start transforming the South for its poorest people, both white and black.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, actually, that's one of the engines of transformation
mm-hmm.
in which of the South in the 20th century.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very interesting. My impression, though, is that World War I
mm-hmm.
did not bring African Americans any of the hoped-for I'm hesitant to call them civil rights, but any of the hoped-for respect that they thought they might receive as a result of service. Am I wrong about that?
No, I'm afraid to say that you are correct.
yeah.
And in fact, actually, you know, once you start reading deeper into the correspondence of African Americans and their own, you start to see some very bitter reactions to the kinds of positions that people like Du Bois took in close
mm-hmm.
ranks.
Yeah.
And, of course, within a short amount of time after the war, even Du Bois himself basically disavowed it and regretted the position that he had taken.
Mm-hmm.
And in large part because the war brought all kinds of outsiders under scrutiny.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, you know, any kinds of statements or questions, challenges to the status quo could be investigated or challenged as, quote, pro-German.
Mm-hmm.
And often there was nothing German about them.
Yeah.
You know, a strike by a group of sharecroppers in the middle of the Delta in
sure.
Mississippi could be described as pro-German, could be thought to be the work of
yeah.
German espionage. And African-Americans, and this is sort of gets back to what I was saying, that the African-American press was, of all the ethnic groups, probably the most outspokenly loyal to the war effort, but it was also the one that was the most under the most scrutiny.
Yeah.
And that the Bureau of Investigation scrutinized the black press. B of I agents personally visited editors of almost every significant black newspaper, you know, sort of paid calls on them in ways that did not formally restrict their papers, but nevertheless made it clear to their editors that they were under close watch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's very interesting. I had the opportunity to interview a fellow named Colin Grant, who wrote what is an excellent book. It's on the site, called A Negro with a Hat. It's about Marcus Garvey, and Marcus Garvey was not one of the people that said that African Americans should necessarily cooperate. I mean, he was proven right, basically, if I recall correctly, he more or less said, we're not going to get anything from this. And I don't know if he said this or somebody said this, but, you know, in response to Wilson saying we need to make the world safe for democracy, either Garvey or somebody said, how about if we make Georgia safe for black people?
Yeah.
Or we do that, which I, well, yeah.
Yeah, and Garvey actually sort of does some of the first organizing in New York that the Garveyites do is in 1917.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
And of course, and right after the war, 1919 is in many ways the one of the worst years for African Americans in terms of violence, in terms of the restriction on black organizations, the number of race riots. It's also one of the years in which membership in African American political organizations boomed, as African Americans sort of come back from the war, many of them disappointed with the outcome that they're seeing around them, determined to change that.
Mm-hmm.
So the NAACP itself expands dramatically, particularly in the South, where it had almost not existed before the war.
Yeah.
And then other groups, Garvey's group obviously expands dramatically right after the war, and some of the sort of more radical groups of African Americans that surround A. Philip Randolph and others.
Yeah, A. Philip Randolph, exactly right.
But a lot of that really happens just after the war and in reaction to the really disastrous events.
Yeah, the history of the NAACP is fascinating. This is a bit of a digression, but another thing that I learned by reading A Negro with a Hat is that at one point when Garvey gets to New York during the war, he goes to what he is told is the offices of the NAACP, but he's very confused. And he later reports that he didn't think it was the NAACP because there were no black people working there.
Right.
Which tells you something about the NAACP's origin, I think. Let me ask you your book ends with a discussion of the surveillance state. How do you conceive of that and its origins? What exactly is it?
Well, the surveillance state is both a thing and a way of being an American citizen. And in the book, the actual thing, the surveillance state that I talk about, is a discussion of particular institutions within the federal government that have to do with regulating immigrants in particular. And the war sees an expansion of power of the federal government to regulate and also to deport non-citizens based on their ideas and their membership in different organizations. So immigrants are one, and then the other is in the Justice Department in the Bureau of Investigation. And that one of the things that was interesting to me is that all of these German enemy aliens who had to register had to send their forms in to the Justice Department, and many of those forms were processed by J. Edgar Hoover, who was just getting his stuff.
Yeah, it's a terrific part of the book. Yeah,
and so obviously the war and the practice experience of regulating and keeping watch on people who are defined by law as enemies is important, and those institutions don't disappear. They aren't dismantled after the war. Many wartime organizations are. The United States takes over the railroad industry, but then it privatizes it again. But these state surveillance institutions do continue after the 1920s, largely because of the Red Scare, right? And with the Russian Revolution, the sort of concerns in the United States about subversion continue.
I found that part of the book quite fascinating because it's something that I've been writing about myself, and I think people would be shocked if they could go back 150 years and to see actually that. But I don't know about most Americans, but many Americans never had any contact whatsoever with the federal government. They just didn't even practically know it was there. I'm thinking of my own people who went to, who went to Kansas. I mean, insofar as they staked their claims, the claims had to be registered, And then, of course, they were probably members of various political organizations, school boards, and that kind of stuff. But other than that, I don't know if they had any contact with the federal government or the federal government had any contact with them. So I thought it was very interesting. And I think I think one of those things, you know, it's there's a huge burst of state power with World War One all over the world. That states become much larger, and they don't. Go ahead.
There is. But one of the things that I try to explain in the book is that it's not just about sort of state institutions getting bigger, but it's also about mindsets and just ways of being and acting.
Yeah.
And so, because a lot of times when historians have looked at World War One, they've said, well, yes, the government, federal government gets much bigger very quickly, and then it gets much smaller.
Uh-huh.
Right? And so, you know, so literally on the morning of November 11th, 1918, when the armistice is signed, the troop trains, you know, literally turn around on the track and start bringing the soldiers home.
Yeah.
Because there's so much pressure to dismantle these large government institutions that many Americans were wary about.
Yeah, yeah.
And so many historians have said, well, you know, look, it just wasn't really that important. But part of what I'm trying to do in the book by looking at both political institutions and political culture is to try to see, well, what about the experiences and mindsets, the memories of this, and even just the different ways that people act because they know now that states can regulate them.
Yeah.
And how we act, you know, or even how people act when they know that they can make certain kinds of claims on the state.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. It was an important precedent. I certainly grant you that, and I think you're right. Actually, it has a kind of echo today in, and people in 100 years will be able to date this interview because of following reference. You know, the way we talk about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, both of which are in trouble, they're nominally private institutions that sort of have the backing of, you know, in some sense, the federal government. But, you know, the idea that the government would allow them to fail is not even really being discussed. It's just taken for granted that they can't be allowed to fail, but nobody explains exactly why. And I think it's because the federal government is in the business and has been for almost 100 years of bailing things out. And I don't know if it was in the business of that before, but there are precedents. I can even remember in my own experience, will date me, is that, you know, the federal government bailed out New York at one point. The federal government bailed out Chrysler at one point. And so why wouldn't it bail out Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac at some point? I mean, and I think you're absolutely right. The apparatus, which is necessary to do these things, really doesn't exist right now. We have to create institutions to bail these, you know, to bail Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac out. But the mindset is definitely there that we can do this.
I think that is true. Although, just as a point of correction, the federal government didn't actually really bail out New York.
Oh, really?
No, that the city workers unions actually took the biggest hit on that by buying the city bonds. But there was a sort of similar public-private partnership set up, something called Big Mac, which did a lot of it. But in fact, actually, Big Mac was only really created because the federal government refused, and that's the origin of that famous Gerald Ford headline, Ford to City Drop Dead.
Yeah, Ford to City Drop Dead. No, that's right. Exactly. So, do you remember that now? Well, I stand corrected.
Sorry.
I sit corrected. Right,
I used to live in New York.
So really?
We get sensitive about the 70s.
Sorry about that. I know it's a great era for film in New York. It's a different story. Anyway, Chris, thanks very much. We really appreciate you being on the show today, and we've taken up a lot of your time, and I'm going to close the interview with our traditional question. What are you working on now?
I am deep into the middle of a new project that is on, once again, on sort of questions of citizenship and military service, but now I'm interested in the Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
And the book is actually a history of Filipino soldiers who serve in the U.S. military and Americans who serve in the military in the Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
And it starts in 1898 in the Spanish-American War and goes all the way up to the present.
Mm-hmm.
A big sweeping history of two countries and a whole century, and I hope it will be fun to read.
No, I mean, I think the Philippines is extraordinarily interesting because it's one place actually Americans really tried imperialism and then kind of didn't like it very much. I don't know, we got there and we sort of toyed with it, and then we said, no, I don't think this is really working out for us. But I think it's a terrific project, and you have to promise to be on the show when you're done with the book.
I'd be happy.
Which will be next year.
Which means, no. It means I have to promise to finish the book.
Yeah, exactly. Good enough. Well, Chris, thanks very much for being on the show. We really appreciate it.
All right, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot. Bye-bye. You've been listening to an interview with Chris Capizzola about his book, Uncle Sam Wants You, World War I and the Making of the Modern American Citizen. It's just come out from Oxford University Press. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. We'll talk to you next week.